A new novel shines a light on the history of social activism and its future through its protagonist, Ray Kelleher.
You know, I think part of what Ray Kelleher's life experiences is, yeah, you win some and you lose some, but you hang in there and don't be discouraged, and that we do have some agency, and that these social movements have made a difference. They stopped a war. They stopped an invasion in Nicaragua. They've stalled and slowed the development of nuclear power. And now, you know, and Ray later joins an effort to try to stop a pipeline that's being built in her neighborhood that's going to bring fracked gas to Boston. And that's a battle that they lose. At the same time, they discourage other fossil fuel infrastructure from being built.
That's Chuck Collins, the writer of numerous nonfiction books. He's out now with a terrific novel, Altar to an Erupting Sun. But first, we take a journey into the heart of climate grief and out the other side with Andrew Boyd. His book is I Want a Better Catastrophe, Navigating the Climate Crisis with Grief, Hope, and Gallows Humor. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour, on the station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. And hey, do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to find extra content with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews? And now you can read transcripts of our conversations on the Writer's Voice Substack. Please spread the word on social media about Writer's Voice. It really helps. Next week is Climate Week at the UN and in New York City generally. And while there's well-deserved skepticism about some greenwashing sponsors of official Climate Week, people from all over the country will be converging on the city streets on Sunday, September 17th, for a march to end fossil fuels. It could be massive, because as wildfires, floods, extreme weather, and tropical diseases spread around the planet, anxiety about the climate emergency is becoming ever more common. Nearly two-thirds of U.S. adults say climate change is noticeably affecting their local communities, and a majority see it as causing serious effects right now. But the pace of change is not enough to avoid a world of hurt ahead of us, even though it's not too late to lessen the impact. We could have a better catastrophe than if we give up and do nothing. That's what threw activist Andrew Boyd into a crisis of hope and off on a quest to learn how to live with the impossible news of our climate doom. In his book, I Want a Better Catastrophe, Boyd searches out 8 leading climate thinkers, from eco-philosopher Joanna Macy to indigenous botanist Robin Wall Kimmerer, and asking them, is it really the end of the world? And if so, now what? With gallows humor and a broken heart, Boyd steers readers through their climate angst as he walks his own. Celebrated Dean of Climate Activism Bill McKibben said, Boyd's book proves it's never too late for a good laugh, a good cry, and a good call to action. I am so glad to welcome you, Andrew Boyd, to Writer's Voice.
Thank you. It's very kind.
Now, in some ways, I think this is the book I've been looking for. As my listeners know, I am a climate activist. But I was looking for a book like this that really does talk about, as the subtitle says, navigating the climate crisis with grief, hope, and gallows humor. I don't know if I was looking for the gallows humor, but that was a new one for me and a good one. The main title is I Want a Better Catastrophe. What do you mean by you want a better catastrophe?
Well, because we're in for catastrophe. So part of the book is, and part of a lot of people's work these days, climate grief counselors and, you know, scientists who tell the truth, the hard truth, are trying to get us oriented towards the fact that, you know, we've missed key, you know, targets. we've missed certain windows for certain better outcomes. We're in for some kind of catastrophe. We're seeing it unfold right around us this summer, especially with record-breaking heat waves across the whole northern hemisphere, floods in Korea, in central Vermont, upstate New York, and all kinds of horrific impacts across the world. We're already in it, and it's going to get worse. And so denying that doesn't allow us to approach our situation with reality and understand what our best options are, what are the most important things to do. So it's trying to help us to let that truth in, to grieve it as we need to grieve it, and then take stock of our situation and how do we get the best possible catastrophe that is still available to us. And so trying to not throw the towel in just because we are in for a very, very rough ride, which we could have avoided if we'd done the right things, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago, and hadn't been prevented from doing them primarily by, you know, a very self-interested fossil fuel industry. But now they've prevented the alternate pathways that we needed to take. So we're in for a catastrophe. And how do we get the best one that's available? How do we get a better catastrophe? And what does a better catastrophe look like? And how do we actually prepare ourselves strategically and spiritually for wanting such an outcome and doing a lot of work and effort and maybe sacrifice to get the, you know, a better catastrophe? I went around and interviewed a lot of people and asked people who had reached the same reckoning and asked them to share what made for a better versus a worse catastrophe and what they were doing to bring it about. So that's part of the book is interviews with people weighing in on that question.
You frame the climate crisis not as a problem, but as a predicament. What is the difference? What do you mean by that?
I think I had this feeling that this category distinction was what I needed to sort of grapple with, but I hadn't come up with the words till I ran across a very key essay by John Michael Greer, who has many hats. he's a visionary sci-fi writer, particularly about, you know, alternative pathways around collapse. Like, there's a book called Retrotopia, which looks at more lo-fi solutions to adapting to a new climate, kind of rougher climate circumstances, for example. He's also a sort of eco-philosopher. He is the former arch-druid of North America.
Yes, in fact, we've had him on the show a couple of times.
Oh, phenomenal. He makes a very strong case for that we're in for a collapse of industrial civilization as we've known it. So alongside everything else, right? Any case, so he's quite a character, and he alerted me, or in a very eloquent way, made this category distinction between what a problem is and what a predicament is. And in short, and I, you know, reference it in the book and reference the essay it came from. I think it's from his blog, Ecosophia. And for him, it's a problem is something that you can solve. You know, a predicament is, for the academics, the social scientists, theorists of complexity refer to it as a wicked problem or a super wicked problem, even in the case of climate. But it is it's a situation that there is no solution to, in the sense that you can fix it and put the problem behind you and move on. There are responses. You can address it. You can ameliorate it. You can mitigate it. But there's no simple enough fix. It's too complex a problem to solve in the sense of that we, you know, the colloquially that we use that. And so it's something we need to learn to live with, adapt to, survive, reckon with, navigate our way through. And there's definitely responses, but there's no fixing it. And so coming to that realization was part of the journey of the book. I carry the reader along on this journey of that reckoning and other reckonings. Try not to pull any punches, because that's what I needed to try to do for myself. And it seems like it's been useful for others. It's not, there's no hope. It's not like there's nothing to be done. It's a very action-oriented book. I think it's a very hopeful book in a certain way, but preceding all of that, it tries to be really honest about how difficult a set of circumstances that we're in and how much more difficult they are destined to become.
Just to get all the really most dire stuff right out of the way at the top here, without losing our listeners, because there is really a lot more beyond this. But you quote conservation biologist Guy McPherson, who says that humans will go extinct by 2026. Not in the next few decades, but in the next 3 years.
I don't think I quote him on that specific statistic. You know, the interview was more trying to begin go to the darkest prognosticator first and work our way towards more, engaged, solution-oriented windows of possibility commentators. So in our interview, he says that he's put off putting a date on things. He has very dire predictions. He does still hold to that we are in for a near-term human extinction, what he calls, but he doesn't put a date on it. I think people that read him that don't challenge his findings put it at a couple generations, but a lot of people do challenge his findings. Some of our most learned scientists, Michael Mann, et cetera, challenge his findings, in a very fundamental way, but that doesn't mean he's not a part of the conversation in that a lot of people have the darkest of feelings about how things are going to unfold, and they sort of see him as someone who's willing to, a scientist, who's been, kicked out of, who's been, kind of treated very poorly by his colleagues and by his, original, university, but nonetheless, who's putting flesh on the bones of those sort of feelings of doom, in terms of stats and projections and all that. But I think that the real takeaway from the interview with him was also he considers himself an activist. He considers himself someone who is taking a very pro-human, moral, ethical, even not in his terms, but people experience it as spiritual approach to even this worst kind of prognostication. And he will say, hey, if we're the last of our species, let's be the best of our species. We still need to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable, even as the ship goes down, in his sort of sense, even as the train goes over the cliff. And that's what the journey here of going on this quest, both kind of a introspective reckoning for myself with confronting these truths and also going out into the world and interviewing these climate thought leaders, including Guy McPherson, trying to come back with gems of, dispositions of thought, frames, spiritual, philosophical, ethical, strategic guidance from these very wise people, activists, scientists, psychologists, philosophers that I interviewed, and come back with guidance for all of us and all the readers that can be of use as we head forward into this unknown and possibly very treacherous future. So he was the first person I talked to, and with the darkest of prognostications. But again, there's sort of a strange light, even in his take on things.
This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with Andrew Boyd about his book, I Want a Better Catastrophe, Navigating the Climate Crisis with Grief, Hope, and Gallows Humor. So let me ask you, all right, let's assume it's not 2026. There is still the sense, I think, among many of us, and I interviewed one of the climate scientists who put out the sixth IPCC report. And she says this, and I think it's true, that it is far, far worse, our situation, than most people understand. And it's still an open question whether we have time. I mean, we don't have time to end climate change, but we may have time to create a survivable future. But we may not. And you say that we have to tell people that there is still time in order to motivate the public to action. And you mentioned Michael Mann. He's criticized the climate doomers, the people say, we're out of time, as just one of the delay and denial messages of the fossil fuel lobby. It's a way to divert from actual action. So how do you grapple with this whole issue? Is there still time? Is there not still time? Or do you just bypass it and say, we don't know?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. It's on everybody's minds. I don't bypass it. I try to hold both parts of it, right? That we have missed some key targets. Paris committed all the signers, all countries, to do everything within power to stay under 1.5 degree centigrade warming, certainly under 2, and do everything we can to stay under 1.5. And basically, if you look at the Climate Action Tracker website, which tracks current pledges and policies and what level of warming that will lead us to, it's pointing to 2.7 degrees centigrade, 2.8, which is terrible, terrible numbers, and portends a terrible sort of lots of suffering for people and lots of destruction of our beloved places and disruption of, normal functioning of society, et cetera. So this information is out there. We all live in a sort of a mixed state of letting it in and denial, which allows us to sort of maintain our equilibrium. And for those of us doing what we can sort of allows us also to remain sort of keep enough wind in our sails to sort of stay focused and do all the good that we can. So yeah, I look at it as like, yes, it's too late, but you need to sort of flesh out what it's too late for, right? So it may be too late to stay under 1.5. Many people agree. It's also never too late, right? It's also never too late to act in defense of people and the planet. It's never too late to care for your neighbor. It's never too late to be kind, to act in solidarity, to do all that you can to protect and adapt and, you know, build resilience into our communities and to mitigate the worst outcome, to bend that emissions curve down as hard and radically as we can to prevent the worst outcomes and to give our adaptation efforts the best chance of success. So there's a piece in the book. And as you said, you know, you mentioned that the book has a sensibility in many places of gallows humor. And, you know, there's a chapter title in the book, which is like, should I tell people how bad I think it is, you know, and that's a question that is on a lot of our minds. And that's I guess it's both a question of your personal sensibility and sentiments and preferences, but it's also a question of what is most strategic. You know, are you going to just demobilize and depress people, or are people going to be like shocked into kind of their moment of climate awakening, you know, and climate truth? And I think we see that people have different reactions. Often there is a moment of shock. There is a moment of depression, maybe of demobilization, but then there's like, okay, like I've seen a lot of people go through this when they look at the, you know, at the numbers on the climate clock, for example, another one of my projects, you know, they report like, whoa, that really hit me, like a full body blow, full reality body blow. And then they recovered. Or people will come to a book talk that I'm giving and, you know, we'll step through all of the stuff that you and I are just talking about. And people say, whoa, I fell back to my house kind of depressed, but then I woke up catharted into okay, rolling up my sleeves. This is where we're at. What do we need to do?
That might belie one of the points you make in the book, because you say that information and fear don't work to engage people around the climate crisis. And I'd like to ask you, well, maybe not only information and fear. I think we need to have a positive view of what we can achieve and what our vision is. But why do you say they don't work? Because they motivate me. And the Climate Reality Project, in fact, is predicated on spreading scientific information about the climate crisis. So say why you don't think it works, and what do you think works better?
No, that's a great point. And I think that maybe is, I wouldn't stand by that statement in isolation. I would say threats, fear attached to real threats that you can identify, you know, can be a great motivator. And information is essential and, you know, very important. I think there's an over-reliance on doom as a prodder towards action, and an over-reliance on if we could just lay out the scientific information that will be sufficient. And I think the point maybe is more that, yes, we should feel like, what does Greta Thunberg say? I want you to be afraid. You should be afraid, you know, because the facts warrant it. And it's absolutely essential, although, you know, heroic work against a lot of criticism and, you know, pressure and even death threats that the climate scientists have been doing for decades is absolutely critical and essential. So no question. I think it needs to be accompanied by a painting, a vision of an alternate path, various solution pathways and an alternate path that our civilization can take, and stories that kind of hold us, right? Stories that allow us to get ourselves oriented, as well as just human, bringing our full humanity to it, right? Acknowledging that this is really hard information to grapple with, you know, acknowledging our own failures and imperfections and weaknesses and terror in the face of it. You know, don't pretend that we've swallowed all this information and we're this, you know, perfect, well-oiled machine that's doing something about it. No, we're all really wrecked and broken and challenged by this, you know? So just bringing all our humanity to it. So I think the fear and information is what is part of a mix of strategy, action steps, better, and you could argue more hopeful, but certainly more honest and more, yeah, stories that are more honest, more hopeful, more solution oriented, more engaging, that situate us like, okay, you know, like I'm not just a taker, as Robin Wall Kimmerer would say. We've been told that humans are just takers, you know, we're just here extracting stuff. We're like a poison, a virus on the planet. And she says, you know, yes, maybe for the last 10,000 years since the invention of civilization and agriculture, and certainly for the last 500 since, you know, the high era of colonialism, and the last 200 of industrialism and the last 30 of the hyper acceleration. Yes, maybe, you know, we have been, you know, objectively takers, but for the vast majority of the history of our species, we've been partners with the earth. You know, we've worked, you know, with an understanding that there's a reciprocal relationship with nature, that we take care of nature and nature will take care of us. So let's change the story that we tell, you know? So doing that alongside the fear and information, I think, is the way forward.
Yes, and so you mentioned Robin Wall Kimmerer. She's the author of Braiding Sweetgrass, which is just a phenomenal bestseller. She says that plants have lessons for us about surviving the climate crisis. What does she say?
Robin Wall Kimmerer is one of the eight people I interviewed alongside, you know, Joanna Macy, Adrienne Marie Brown, Gopal Dayanani, Tim DeChristopher, and others. And it was one of the more beautiful interviews. And, you know, it's just lovely to sit with Robin Wall Kimmerer for a couple hours by a fire in upstate New York in the Adirondack State Park and talk to her about how she interweaves scientific knowledge, botany in particular, and traditional indigenous wisdom. But she thinks of plants as our elders, as our teachers. Arguably, they've had a solar economy operating for hundreds of millions of years. We have something to learn from them. You know, they have, you know, beautiful reciprocity and exhibit. She'll look at this notion of biomimicry and what all that we have to learn from how nature operates and how indigenous cultures operate in harmony with nature, and that we need to take a page from that book. And she talks about a honorable harvest and how we can change our food systems, you know, in light of those things, and, you know, twin traditional wisdom with scientific knowledge. So part of the book is a journey, you know, myself, multiple decades of being an activist and sort of going through a crisis of hope as I confront the facts on the ground about our climate situation and its worsening trajectory, and just having a gut check moment of truth that sets me off on a search. I talk to, you know, Robin Wall Kimmerer and other wise climate thought leaders and try to, you know, ask them, what does hope look like in the face of this, what often feels like doom? How do we not succumb to, well, there's nothing to be done and throw in the towel, or fake optimism of like, hey, we can turn this all around, it's all fixable? What's the middle path there between a realistic assessment and finding things that we can do to both mitigate and adapt and create a survivable planet for ourselves and our and future generations, and protect the people we love and the places we love? And it's full of tools and stories and, you know, dispositions of spirit, frames of mind that will help us navigate our way forward. And then there's a lot of laughs also. Somehow I managed to, in the gallows humor kind of approach that I have worked into previous books and previous projects, political, you know, theater and media projects, bring that to bear to make it all that much more bearable for people to grapple with this by bringing out the all too human cosmic sort of humor dimension.
So as a last question, you ask people what is their better catastrophe. Just briefly, tell us one thing, the most important thing about what would represent your better catastrophe.
Gopal Dayanani, who's a leading voice in the climate justice, environmental justice movement, who I sat down with in Oakland, you know, said, look, we're in for a lot of suffering. We need to distribute that suffering as equitably as we can. So for him, justice. If we center justice in how we respond to the crisis, then that will lead us to a better catastrophe. We're still in for catastrophe, but it's a better one. Adrienne Marie Brown shared this beautiful, she says, yes, we're in for a hard fall. So how do we fall as if we were holding a child on our chest and falling in a way that protected that child? So how do we protect those most vulnerable, those who are least able to protect themselves as things unravel? It's in this sort of light, hope in the dark notion from Rebecca Solnit, or the light that sort of threaded through the darkness in terms of how we respond with justice, with care, doing all that we can, identifying what is still worth doing and doing it and not giving up. I think a better catastrophe lies in that.
Well, Andrew Boyd, it's a great book. It has a really interesting flow chart as well, which we didn't have time to get into, but I would highly recommend to my readers to get the book and to discover that flow chart.
I'll just mention the flowchart is interactive. You can take your own journeys on it on the website, bettercatastrophe.com. And if you know, bettercatastrophe.com/flowchart, you can go on a journey through our climate predicament in a user-directed, in a sort of self-directed kind of way. There's some narration from me, which you can turn on and off as you wish, and then go on your own journey. So that's at bettercatastrophe.com.
Oh, that's great. And we will link to that. The book is I Want a Better Catastrophe, Navigating the Climate Crisis with Grief, Hope, and Gallows Humor. Andrew Boyd, thank you so much for talking with us.
Such a pleasure. Thank you.
Andrew Boyd. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to Boyd's interactive flowchart to map your own way to a better catastrophe. Next up, a near future story of one community facing climate disruption in the critical decade ahead. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're celebrating the upcoming Climate Week by featuring two books that tackle the crisis from different perspectives. We heard from Andrew Boyd about learning to live with the climate emergency without losing hope, compassion, and courage. Chuck Collins took another tack. Author of several nonfiction books, Collins decided to use fiction to explore how social justice activism has dealt with grave crises before and how the lessons learned from those struggles can inform how we deal with the climate emergency today and in the years to come. Chuck Collins is the director of the Program on Inequality and the Common Good at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he co-edits inequality.org. He's co-founder of DivestInvest.org, a global movement to divest from fossil fuels and invest in climate solutions. Chuck Collins, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Great to be with you. Thanks for having me back, Francesca.
Well, I was quite surprised to hear that you had written a novel. You've written a memoir. You've written other books. You're involved with the Institute for Policy Studies for many, many years. Altar to an Erupting Sun. First, just tell us a little bit about that title and why the word altar means so much for you.
Well, yeah, this is my first foray into fiction. And the book is, in a way, it's an altar. It is in the tradition of a remembrance altar, celebrating people, elders, people who've gone ahead of me. But also an altar to the social movements that form me and so many of us. So that's really the altar aspect of it. And the main character in the book, Ray Kelleher, learns about the power of altars and is kind of a builder of public and private altars.
So when you may say builder of public and private altars, what we're really talking about are a whole history. I mean, the book is a kind of a primer to the history of social justice movements from the 1970s to the present in the United States. Ray, you've mentioned her, Ray Kelleher. You begin the novel. I don't think it's going to be a surprise to our readers. I don't think this is really giving anything too much away. With an act of violence, a suicide bombing by Ray, who had before dedicated her life to nonviolent activism in the service of social justice. So tell us about Ray Kelleher and what brought her to her final act.
Well, yeah, it's not a spoiler alert. That's how the book begins. Ray is at the end of her life. She is facing down a terminal illness. She doesn't have long to live. And as you say, Francesca, she spent her whole life part of nonviolent movements. And yet here she is at the end of her life. She decides to go out, taking her own life and the life of the CEO of a fossil fuel company. And it is a provocative beginning, but it invites this question, why did she do this? And that's a bit of the history, what formed her and what impact did it have? So there's a little bit of 7 years into the future fiction, where we look at the considerable negative blowback from her shocking exit, as well as some ways in which society started to shift. So it's really an exploration of the traditions of nonviolence, the different kinds of bold actions that people take, and this unthinkable, shocking act that Ray takes. So it's really an exploration of why And that really is the story.
So let's go to how you explore the why. The early part of the book takes place in Montague, Massachusetts, at a real so-called commune in the 1970s with real people, Sam Lovejoy, Wally and Juanita Nelson, and Chuck Mathai. Tell us about that farm and its connection to the Hidden River Farm in 2016 and beyond.
Well, you know, it is a work of fiction, but I enjoyed weaving in real life people and real life places. It's very much of a place-based novel. Although if you don't live in Western Mass or Southern Vermont, I think you'll find that there are elements of place wherever you live. But in this case, you know, Ray is 19 years old, Ray Kelleher. She drops out of college because of the moment that she's living in. 1973, the Vietnam War is happening. The U.S. has just helped overthrow a democratic government in Chile. And she is feeling like, I just can't sit still in college. And so she joins a very engaged activist commune. And again, she's 19 years old, going to live with people like Sam Lovejoy, who was very active in the anti-nuclear power movement and sort of was an example of taking a bold witness. And in his case, he clipped and toppled a weather tower that was being used by the nuclear power plant company that wanted to build the plant, turned himself in, kind of an act of civil disobedience and property destruction, and he goes to trial for that. And Ray Kelleher, the fictional Ray Kelleher, sort of has a front row seat to all these things unfolding around her. So these are the people who shape her. And you think about all of us in our early 20s and who we meet, meeting Wally and Juanita Nelson, who are civil rights activists, war tax resistors, among the few African Americans living in rural Western Mass. But they are living witnesses to the power of nonviolence and trying to live a nonviolent life. You know, my hope is that people will learn about these social movements, but then, yeah, reflect on this moment we're in, the impossible news of climate disruption, and what is it we're called to do in this moment, which I think is different than 50 years ago.
I just love the way you describe the vision of community that, you know, that inspired so many of us in the 70s and continues to inspire people today. A vision of community that is really set increasingly against a complete erosion of community in the larger society. Describe that vision of community in that farm, a committed community that went beyond its, committed to issues way beyond its borders.
Yeah, I think, you know, Ray Kelleher is lucky at age 19 to find these people, to find a community, because, you know, as we know, so many people feel isolated and disconnected and don't have that aspect in their life. And, you know, these people depended on each other. They engaged in civil disobedience together. They grew food together and they celebrated. And there were children around and there was a sense of joy and mutual aid among the community. And as Ray ages, she wants that again. And she, you know, later in her life, she calls herself sort of a late in life back to the lander, but she and a group of people, you know, together buy a farm, and now they're in their 50s and 60s, and they realize to face a disrupted future, to face the coming years, you know, we're going to need each other. We're going to need mutual aid. And she sort of says that there's a little bit of a joke there, which is, well, we don't all want to live in the same house and have the same kitchen and bathroom, but maybe it's more like co-housing. Maybe it's more like, you know, we live really close to each other. We share a great deal. We have a little bit of more private space, private lives, but we're trying to have that, weave that sense of community and celebration and joy of life together, because that's how we're going to get survive the coming years.
Yeah. And could you delve more deeply into a description of that later community at Hidden River Farm in Guilford, Vermont? What are the things that people do? And first, you know, tell us, how does mutual aid, after all, mutual aid is a movement, certainly in this book, that begins in the city and then is translated to the country. Describe how that works in this place.
Well, they live in a rural community, so they're connected to sort of the wider community and their neighbors. But at the farm, they're trying to grow food. They're trying to add value to the food that they grow, creating products, maple syrup and black garlic spread, and all kinds of things that, you know, create livelihoods in a market. They welcome newcomers. You know, they understand we're living in a disrupted time, that there are climate refugees and even political refugees from other parts of the country and part of the world who need a place to live, and they have one of their livelihoods is they actually have sort of a death doula, death and dying coaching and support business. And they operate a memorial grove, essentially a forest cemetery for people who want to die and have their remains stay in this forest. So they've woven together a bunch of livelihoods. There's some people, obviously, who still work off the farm and for other kinds of jobs. But it's a good example of they get their costs. Their costs are lower because they're living together and they're sharing expenses. And the mutual aid comes in from just helping neighbors, bartering and sharing and working together to build community resilience to face the ecologically disrupted future.
And I loved that death doula business that they do, because you describe it in great detail, and there is a climate-connected reason behind it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that Ray Kelleher believes we're not really going to face the future until we face and understand our own mortality, address the sort of death phobia in our culture. So she's really a believer that a healthy approach to death, including, you know, the building altars as a way to honor those who've gone before us, retain a connection to ancestors. We're going to have to, in Ray's view, draw on the power of our ancestors to help us face the future. Ancestors, many of whom have faced even, you know, great struggles in their own past. Part of her view is let's be honest and talk about death. Let's sort of face it. Let's demedicalize it. Let's celebrate lives while people are still here. So they kind of institute a practice of, one person calls them living shivas, or their memorial services while the person is still alive, to celebrate their lives, not waiting till after they die. So those are aspects of a culture shift that Ray thinks is important in how we face the future.
And even to the details, you know, when my mother passed away in 2012, I just kind of automatically had her cremated. That's what she had told me she wanted. And it was to my horror that I later discovered that the process of cremation is carbon intensive. So you really do go into the details of, you know, this farm providing people with wicker coffins. You talk about burying the bodies 3.5 feet deep, not 6 feet deep, which is now allowed by Vermont. And it is a level at which bacteria can break down the body. It's a process of renewal and rebirth that is contained within death. Is that right?
Absolutely. And I think they realize that there's this opportunity to change the culture and change the burial practices, as you described, Francesca. You know, that we are part of nature. And one of the businesses of the farm is they weave willow coffins, willow baskets and willow coffins, which biodegrade quickly. Or people are simply buried in a shroud. As one character says, you know, wrap me up in my wine-stained tablecloth, the one that I've had at my birthday table for the last 10 years, that's my shroud. And I'm going to go down gently into the ground in that. So, you know, you don't have these, you know, large lacquer rainforest wood coffins and expensive burial processes and cremationist, which, as you say, you know, is another unnecessary source of carbon emissions, when in fact our bodies can break down and join the great cycle. And I think that's sort of the new view and the new culture. And I see it kind of emerging around me, but it was fun to sort of imagine it playing out into the future, some of these trends and new practices. I think it we're heading toward a healthier way of facing the end of each of our lives, not just handing it over to doctors to prolong at any expense.
So, Chuck Collins, let's go back to the past again. As we said before, Altar to an Erupting Sun, your novel, follows many of the key struggles that social justice activists in the U.S. have waged throughout the decades since the 1970s. You talked a bit about the anti-nuclear movement, Sam Lovejoy, who tore down a tower at a proposed nuclear plant. Also, you talk about the demonstrations that occurred at the Seabrook nuclear plant. I remember going there when my son was 2 years old, and it was really a really joyous occasion, but it had a very serious purpose. Talk about the impact of the anti-nuclear movement on the development of nuclear power in the U.S., because it was profound.
Yeah, you know, that the nuclear power industry kind of had a free run, really, 50s to 1960s and even into the 70s. The assumption was that nuclear power was going to be the answer. We were going to build hundreds of nuclear power plants. It was going to, electricity was going to be too cheap to meter. You know, it was going to be like free. And yet, throughout U.S. history of nuclear power plants, there's been a number of accidents. There was an accident outside Detroit that almost was a core meltdown. But there was no movement there. And I think one of the lessons that Ray Kelleher realizes is you need to do organizing and preparation and education, even when it doesn't feel like you're winning. You know, and so that's what they did. They set out and they educated their communities, and they showed up at the board meetings, and they learned about the dangers of nuclear power and the economics of nuclear power and nuclear waste. And they just kept pushing and pushing. Then, you know, there's an accident at Three Mile Island, but they're organized. They've already done the groundwork, and that movement then rises up and takes advantage essentially of this moment when people are paying attention to the dangers of nuclear power. And essentially, no new power plants are licensed, you know, after 1980. For decades, a couple small nuclear reactors have been licensed in recent years. But that movement really stopped the construction of nuclear power plants and the decommissioning of many others. So it was a great example of the importance of people power. If that movement hadn't been there after Three Mile Island, you can imagine the status quo just would have continued on. And Ray, that's a life lesson for Ray, which is, you know, you do the organizing and education even when you can't necessarily see the impact, because what you're doing is preparing for a trigger moment. You're preparing for something that may draw people's attention and awareness to it, and then you want to be organized and ready to go.
And do you feel that lesson also obtains in one of the other struggles that you write about in the book, that is the fight against U.S. imperialism in Latin America? You have Ray go to Nicaragua and El Salvador. Talk about those efforts and her work with the School of the Americas Watch and your own experience with the Institute of Policy Studies that lost two members to violence around the School of the Americas.
Yeah, you know, during the 1980s, you had the Reagan administration funneling military aid to the dictatorship in El Salvador. They were trying to fund a mercenary army to overthrow the Nicaraguan government. And lots of people from the U.S. went to Central America. They actually went to Nicaragua. They, as an expression of friendship, they picked cotton and coffee. And the fictional Ray Kelleher was part of that. And part of what happened there is a whole generation of people had this experience of working in Central America, getting outside of the U.S. bubble, seeing the relationship of the U.S. and U.S. foreign policy to the rest of the world. And also that by their physical presence there, probably deterred a U.S. invasion. The United States, the Reagan administration was developing plans to directly invade and reverse the Sandinista government there. And the fact that there were thousands of people working and living in Central America, volunteering, was a source of deterrent. And all those people came back and became active in their local communities. And Ray Kelleher was an example of that. And she then asked this question, well, who's training the Salvadoran military? Who's training the dictators in Chile? And learns that the United States and Georgia has the School of Americas, which is essentially a training facility for military leaders from Latin America, most of whom working for dictators. And so she is part of this movement to shut down the School of the Americas and draw attention to it. And you mentioned, you know, I work at the Institute for Policy Studies. One of our colleagues, two of our colleagues were assassinated by a Chilean hit squad that was trained by the U.S. at the School of the Americas. So there's a direct connection there. So, you know, it was an example that most people living in the United States wouldn't understand, that our government is backing the wrong people in a lot of these struggles. They're backing the dictators and they're backing the status quo, and they're opposing people who are working for their freedom and independence.
Yeah. And, you know, I also think what's noteworthy is the impact. You know, so often, so many of us who've been involved in these struggles for so many decades just kind of look at the catastrophe unfolding around us and wonder, you know, what did we do? So I wonder if you could weigh in on that, because I feel that the book allows us to celebrate, in a way, our victories, but also to grapple with our failures. What's your own perspective on that?
Yeah, you know, I think part of what Ray Kelleher's life experience is, yeah, you win some and you lose some, but you hang in there and don't be discouraged. And that we do have some agency, and that these social movements have made a difference. They stopped a war. They stopped an invasion in Nicaragua. They've stalled and slowed the development of nuclear power. And now, you know, and Ray later joins an effort to try to stop a pipeline that's being built in her neighborhood that's going to bring fracked gas to Boston. And that's a battle that they lose. At the same time, they discourage other pipeline, other fossil fuel infrastructure from being built. So you can sort of see that she's plugging away. She's looking for places to make a difference. But as she starts to dig into the climate crisis, she realizes, whoa, the rules are rigged here. You know, trying to oppose a pipeline when you have federal laws that basically give private energy companies the power to just take streets by eminent domain, overriding local and state government. These are all things that Ray just starts to wake up to. It's like, wow. The fossil fuel industry really has captured our political system. So that's one of the, she's bringing her organizer campaigner insights into this moment, but also realizing, boy, this is going to be a tough one to stop the fossil fuel industry because they are so powerful. And that's one of the things that really shapes her at the end of her life.
Right. And so here we go to, she has announced to her group at Hidden Valley Farm, I'm going to go to your book here, Altar to an Erupting Sun, where she reveals her plan to blow herself up and to take out an oil company executive. And her husband, Reggie, pushes back, and he gives all the reasons why that's not a good idea. So let's start there, and then I'm going to read how Ray responds to him. So what does Reggie say?
Well, he and she doesn't really tell many people. She tells Reggie in a kind of intimate way, just saying she's thinking about this, and he just says, this is a terrible idea. It may be cathartic for you, but it's going to have tremendous negative repercussions. Violence just begets violence in our culture. It will lead to the repression of the movements that you care about. It may even lead to, you know, arrests among people at the farm. So don't do it. Think about other, you know, insist on not just having a peaceful exit. Think about other things. Think about self-immolation, which is another tradition that is kind of discussed in the book. but doesn't take the lives of other people. So they really have it out, and they do convene a little group of four, including Ray and Reggie, where they really kind of explore the debates about violence and nonviolence. And that's part of what I wanted to do in the book, was sort of lay it all out in a way that younger people today and anyone today can sort of think about the negative repercussions of such an action.
And so Reggie has said it's going to occasion this huge blowback. And Ray answers him, and I'm going to quote from your book here, Chuck Collins. "I've thought about that," said Ray. "We're at a different stage in the global movement around climate change. For 20 years, we've been watching emissions rise. We've had how many COP summits with how many thousands of pledges, and it doesn't change anything. It doesn't change the trajectory. It doesn't stop the efforts from planning the destruction of Mother Earth and growing their profits. As we sit here, there are men sitting in boardrooms making decisions to invest trillions in new oil and gas infrastructure that will blow humanity past any sustainable temperature limits." And then she goes on to say, "I think it opens up another flank in the movement to keep fossil fuels in the ground. Target companies that are still extracting and their decision makers." She says, "A lot of social change in history has happened because of violence or the threat of violence." So weigh in on her point of view on this. You know, there is a book, How to Blow Up a Pipeline. I think many of us look at the mass murder. I mean, I have a button that says climate change equals mass murder. You know, I wonder every day, how have we come to the pass that a few individuals are threatening all life on Earth here and the evolution of hundreds of millions of years for their short-term profits with no real consequences? So weigh in on her point of view.
Well, I think that quote that you read is such an important point in terms of Ray's state of mind. She feels that powerlessness. She is feeling rage. And one thing I notice is people sort of say, well, we should face the future and face the grief of loss. And at different points, Ray is like, well, I'll face the grief, but I'm going to face my anger and rage first. You know, like, don't forget about that stage of our process here. But, you know, she sees how the political system is captured and how our political system, think of the U.S. Congress right now, completely incapable of responding to the challenge that we face. So, you know, I think she's feeling that there's not a lot of other options. That combined with the fact that she's kind of now at the end of her life facing her own mortality and wanting to do something dramatic to make a difference. And, You can empathize with that, you know, given the moment we're in. At the end of her book, her kind of adopted daughter, Alex, says what Ray did was wrong. But what Ray would say is, what bold action are you called to do to defend Mother Earth? And I believe, now speaking as not the author or the fictional Ray character, but I believe there are these pressure points still where we can make a difference. But it's going to not be easy. It's going to require much more disruptive tactics. I heard this morning that two people have shut down, engaged in civil disobedience to physically shut down Line 5, which is the Enbridge oil pipeline in Michigan. It's the anniversary of the oil leak into the Kalamazoo River. And so activists, probably risking serious jail time, have gone out and literally shut the valves down, engaging in that. So, you know, I think we will see, understandably, more militant tactics, more expressions at not just the fossil fuel industry, but their financial enablers. So, you know, there's a group, Third Act, which is folks over 60 who are thinking about climate change and wanting to take bold action. They're focusing on, you know, the JP Morgans and the Chases, the big financial companies that
invest in this new fossil fuel infrastructure. We're going to have to put our bodies on the line to stop new fossil fuel infrastructure from being constructed. Where I live in New England, there's a plan to expand a private jet airport 400% so that the ultra rich can fly their private jets more and more. That's a bad idea. That's a huge emission carbon bomb that would put billions of tons of carbon into the atmosphere. So people are going to put their bodies on the line to stop the expansion of new infrastructure like that. That's really what we need to be doing in the coming years. And each of us sort of have to ask, what are each of us willing to do for the sake of the future, as well as our immediate lives?
Mm-hmm. Well, Chuck Collins, it's just been great to talk with you about this novel that explores all these issues and more. I mean, it's just a wonderful guide and primer to a decades-long movement that is becoming ever more important, Altar to an Erupting Sun. Thank you so much for talking with us here.
Thank you, Francesca.
Chuck Collins. Go to writersvoice.net for a link to resources about the novel Altar to an Erupting Sun, including a discussion guide and a further reading list. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Listen again for free, read book excerpts, and sign up for the podcast at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.